so much for coming this evening. We are very, very lucky to have Dr. Christian Coetzel-Rixon with us today. He is the Fellow for the Middle East at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. His research spans the political economy and international relations of the Gulf states and their changing positions within the regional and global order. Christian holds a PhD in history from the University of Cambridge. We're not supposed to mention that, but that's all right. That's a typical joke in Oxford, isn't it? So he's also the author of 7 books, including Insecure Gulf, The End of Certainty and the Transition to the Post-Oil Era, published in 2011, The United Arab Emirates, Power, Politics and Policymaking, published in 2016, Qatar and the Gulf Crisis by Oxford University Press, published in 2020, and most recently, and this is the book that we'll be discussing today, I know all of you are very excited, I am very excited certainly, Kingdom of Football, Saudi Arabia and the Remaking of World Soccer, published in 2025 by Oxford University Press, that I can mention. Prior to joining the Baker Institute in 2013, he co-directed the Kuwait Research Program at the London School of Economics for 5 years from 2008 and served as an Associate Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs at Chatham House between 2012 and 2022. So to have him speak today is actually a treat. And we are very lucky to have you back, because last time you were here, you told me just now that you were here in 2003. So this is a really an exciting opportunity for you to speak, especially to speak about your latest book on a subject that is widely discussed, but on which not much academic work has actually been published. And I don't want to speak anymore. Without further delay, I will invite you to the book.
Well, thank you very much for having me, for inviting me to the college, to the Middle East Center, and to Oxford. And like you said, I came in 2003 to meet Peter Stuglitz, and it's amazing to think that 23 years have passed. I think we were talking about the potential for the US to invade Iraq, which was just about to happen, and so much has happened since. And it's great to be back in Oxford. I haven't been back in Oxford since 2013, so it's been very nice to reacquaint with Oxford for a few days. I did sneak in my Cambridge College tie. I thought if I wore my Cambridge University one, it might be too provocative, so I kept it low key. I've written a book about football, partly because I'm a massive football fan, but also because I've been working on the Gulf for now 20 years. And over time, I noticed that the Gulf states were becoming more and more directly involved in football and sport more generally. And I mean, I think I first began to realize that in the 2000s, when you had Emirates Stadium and Arsenal, then Etihad Stadium at Manchester City. Going to the Emirates, going to the Etihad became part of the language of English football. You had sponsorships proliferating. Then obviously in 2009, Manchester City were acquired by the by Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the brother of the president of the UAE, became overnight almost very successful. The Qataris bought Paris Saint-Germain in 2010, again, almost overnight success. And of course in 2010 as well, Qatar won the hosting rights to the 2022 World Cup. And I still remember the shock in the office at the LSE when that happened, punctuated by a shriek of delight from the woman next door in my office, whose father had been the US ambassador in Qatar in the 1990s, who had really sort of set up Education City, and she had been absolutely thrilled. She'd gone to school with some of the emir's brothers and sisters. So that shriek of delight from her office had alerted me to the good news that something had happened. Also, for this book, I wanted to look at how Saudi Arabia has sort of burst onto the scene, the kind of scene of world football. And I began looking at it in 2023, so just after Ronaldo had moved to Al Nassr at the end of 2022. And then that kind of frenetic summer of 23 when it seemed like almost every major soccer star, football star, sorry, I still live in the US and I still have to be careful about whether I call it football or soccer. And we put it both in the title of the book just to cover our bases. So I started writing it working on it in 2023. And Sadison moved in major ways as an investor, an owner, a sponsor, a host, and as a participant. And in some ways they're following, again, as in so many other walks of life, they're following the Emiratis, who did this 25, 30 years ago. Qatar has stolen the march, purposely becoming the first Middle Eastern, first Arab state to host the World Cup. Iran became the first regional state to qualify for the World Cup back in 1978. So the Saudis are kind of following others who've taken the lead. But the level of resources the Saudis have put into the project over the last several years, which may or may not be being scaled back and reassessed at the moment, means they have gone a lot further. And of course, now we have the 2034 World Cup, Men's World Cup, to look forward to in the kingdom. So another 9 or 8 years now of further sort of Saudi football chatter. So they're not the first to do so. And my book was an attempt to try and look at why they were doing so now and how it links to some of the broader processes of political and economic reform, change, evolution, whatever you would call it, in Saudi Arabia. And I began the book with a quote from an article I found in the Washington Post, which begins with the following sentence. After using their petrodollars to buy conglomerates, hotels, and famous paintings, Arab moneymen now have turned to the world of sport and launched an ambitious free-spending campaign to buy some of the world's top soccer talent. And that was in 1978. And it was about Saudi Arabia. It was about the captain of Brazil, Rivelino, who had just moved to Al-Hilal. And at that time, the Saudi Pro League was only 2 years old. It had been formed in 1976. And here was the captain of Brazil's World Cup team in 78, who played with Pelé in the 70 World Cup, suddenly turning up in Riyadh. Not quite at the peak of his career, but close enough. And that year, Iran had qualified for the World Cup. Saudi Arabia was clearly hoping to do its own big waves. In fact, they wanted success. They also were briefing the media. Later in the same Washington Post article, they talk about how he's going to be the first of many. They were talking about Zico, the great Brazilian teammate. Following him, they offered Zico apparently a world record transfer fee. It didn't work out, and Rivelino turned out to be one of the only superstars at the time to go to Saudi Arabia. Now, the Saudi League began in 76, but Saudi teams, you know, the oldest, have their origins in the 1920s and 1930s. So football's been around for a lot longer than maybe some of the outside commentary will lead you to suggest. Al-Ittihad, for example, in Jeddah, which founded in 1927, I think, and so that's a centenary coming up. As with so much in terms of economic development, the first teams were on the coasts, on the eastern coast, the western coast, and the Hejaz, the eastern province. And then later in the 1940s and 50s in Riyadh with Al-Nasr and Al-Hilal. You had provincial leagues in the 1950s and then coalescing into a national league in 1975-76. The assassination of King Faisal in 1975 meant everything was pushed back for a few months. But then in 1976, the beginning of a national league. What's interesting from a British point of view is that the technical director hired by the Saudis in 1976 to, in their view, unveil the blueprint for football development was a certain Jimmy Hill. And Jimmy Hill, for those of you who remember him, was a former player at Coventry City who then became a manager and owner of Coventry and much later quite well known on the BBC as a pundit. He had a sort of very long chin with a sort of goatee moustache and he became quite controversial. And he turned up in Saudi Arabia in 1976 with a plan to revolutionize Saudi football, to sort of make it big. He brought in a number of people with him, all from the UK, including David Icke, who is maybe charitably described as a conspiracy theorist par excellence. At the time, he was maybe more mainstream. He wrote to the BBC for a time. But over time, his views, I think, probably diverged from the mainstream. There's another book, by the way, that just came out last year by James Montague, which is very interesting, called Engulfed, and it's about Saudi Arabian sport, which was football. And he actually tracked David Icke down and interviewed him about his memories of living in Riyadh in 1976. And it's only about a page or a page and a half. It's quite interesting. I didn't do the same, but Jimmy Hill was only there for 3 years. He hired all these old school British coaches who were old school even by their time in the UK. They were still less able to adapt, living in an extremely different context and environment. So they refused to learn the language. They refused even to learn the players' names in some cases. One of the coaches referred to the players by their numbers. He never even bothered to learn the names. They replaced the Hungarian legend Ferenc Puskas with one of these old school British coaches. Things didn't go as well as planned. Hill left in 1979, had some money that he'd made. He then invested in the North American Soccer League and lost the entire fortune he'd made in Saudi Arabia by investing in the North American League. And the experiment more or less was aborted. That said, Saudi Arabia began becoming successful in the 1980s. The national team got to the final of 5 successive Asian Cups between 1984 and 2000, winning 3 of them. And that 5 finals in a row is still, I think, a record. Iran had won 3 in a row in the 1960s and 70s, but 5 finals in a row is something that is unmatched. They also began to win club-level tournaments, the Asian Champions League in the 1980s and 90s. And I think people of my generation remember the last time the World Cup was in the US in 1994, and Saudi Arabia defeated Belgium, qualified for the second round, with that goal that was kind of very much like Maradona's goal against England in 1986. That said, the millennium, around the time of the millennium, had momentum slowing. The successes began to dry up. National team lost 8-0 to Germany in 2002. There were heavy defeats in other World Cups. It didn't qualify in 2010 or in 2014. And then, of course, the pandemic intervened in 2020. And there were plans to privatize Saudi clubs, which had been funded by the government or funded by the state, which had stalled. And Saudi Arabia also had a reputation in the 2010s of not paying players on time. There were a number of cases, arbitration cases against Saudi Arabia. Players were being advised not to move to Saudi Arabia, also to Turkey and other countries too. So by the time the pandemic happened, it wasn't in a great place. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the challenges of writing this book, I mean, there are several challenges, partly to what extent would be a book about football or a book about Saudi politics and Vision 2030 and economic reform and how to bring it together. And that was one challenge, because obviously what's happened, I think, is indistinguishable from Vision 2030, from Mohammed Salman's efforts to attract inward investment, tourism, other flows of capital. And then also my publisher was understandably keen to try to broaden the audience of the book away from just an academic audience and to write a book that would appeal not just to academics, but also to football fans who might not have a deep or any background in Saudi politics. So, I mean, I had to have chapters on Mohammed Salman, on Vision 2030, to kind of introduce the context, but to try and sort of appeal to a wider readership. So I do look at MBS, Mohammed Salman's rise, and the centrality of Vision 2030, but of the centrality of the Public Investment Fund to that vision. And the Public Investment Fund has been at the core of so much of the Saudi initiatives in football and in sport. It may seem less obvious now in 2026, but back in 2010, 2011, the rise of Mohammed Salman was not seen as inevitable. I have a 52-page PDF on my computer of succession dynamics in Saudi Arabia from 2010 that was produced by the Gulf States News or newsletter, which has been going since the 70s. They're trying to second guess what would happen once the generation of sons of Abdulaziz ended and went down a generation. It's 52 pages long, and Mohammed Salman has 3 lines on page 45. I mean, he was a much younger son of, at that point, the 4th in line to the throne. The crown prince was Sultan, then the second deputy prime minister was Nayef, and then Salman, maybe 3rd in line. And then within 6 months, in 2010, 2011, the two crown princes, first Sir Sultan and Nayef, passed away, and suddenly Salman was crown prince. And he turned to his son, Mohammed Salman, to really push through. Well, he began to rely on him much more heavily, even though, and again this may have fed into the page 45, he had much more accomplished, much older sons from his first wife. The current energy minister, Prince Abdulaziz, being one of them, Prince Sultan, the first astronaut from the Arab world who went into space in 1986, the year after Mohammed Salman was born. His brother Abdulaziz joined the energy ministry the same year. So much older, much more professionally accomplished, half brothers. But for whatever reason, and people have speculated about this, including some in the kingdom, the reason why he picked Mohammed Salman, he did. And by 2013, Mohammed Salman had a ministerial rank. By 2014, he was his father's gatekeeper, as head of the royal, his father's court. And of course, by January 2015, when the succession happened, he was ready to go. He's appointed Minister of Defense in January 2015. 3 months later, he became Deputy Crown Prince, moving into the line of succession at the age of 29, which, again, I think shocked many observers of Saudi Arabia, just because they hadn't seen it coming. But in some ways, it was a throwback to the 1950s, when Saudi Arabia was governed by princes in their 20s and 30s. The problem was they'd grown old together. The Sultan, who had been Minister of Defense for 48 years, was also a young Minister of Defense at the beginning. He was about 30 when he was appointed. The problem is he was then there for 48 years. So by 2015, Mohammed Salman was obviously on the rise. He was also, he gained oversight over Saudi energy policy with Aramco and investment policy, becoming governor of the, or chairman of the board of the Public Investment Fund with his confidant Yasser al-Umayyan as governor. So by 2015, he was primed to push through his vision, which became Vision 2030, of a long-term process of change to try and transform Saudi's economy. As we now know, the first couple of years were bumpy, shall we say the least. There was the war in Yemen, the intervention in March 2015, which clearly has not gone as hoped. Operation Decisive Storm was neither decisive nor a storm of success. There were other foreign policy decisions, the blockade of Qatar in 2017, the mysterious detention of Saad Hariri in Lebanon, in Riyadh in 2017. Obviously the Ritz-Carlton affair also in 2017, the same day I think as the Hariri detention, which some people initially were wondering, is that part of the same process? There were diplomatic disputes, there was one with Canada in 2018, for example, and of course the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in October 2018, really, I think, for many, epitomized what was becoming a narrative of a reckless or an impulsive, by that point, crown prince, who became crown prince in 2017, who was prepared to break things and move fast, but not necessarily think about the consequences. And he had launched Vision 2030 in 2016, so within 2 years of that launch, and having toured the US for 6 weeks at the beginning of 2018, meeting, I think, four former US presidents, including the two Bushes in Houston, and meeting all the tech titans in New York and in Silicon Valley and in Seattle, he met Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates. Having gone from being a sort of poster for the new generation, he became, as Joe Biden famously put it in 2019, a pariah. And so by 2019, and then the pandemic, he was in difficulty. Donald Trump lost the election in 2020. Joe Biden was coming in. He had obviously made those comments about Mohammed Salman. He made them during a Democrat debate in 2019, when all the candidates were trying to out-compete each other to be tough on the Saudi, on Mohammed Salman. But of course, Biden was the one who then became president, had to live with the consequences of his words. In the first year of the Biden presidency, he refused to deal with Mohammed Salman. He delegated it to his Minister of Defense, his Secretary of Defense, Lord Austin, saying, well, he's Minister of Defense, you're the Minister of Defense, you work together. But it soon became apparent that, especially once a full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine happened, you couldn't just isolate Saudi Arabia. You had to get the Saudis back on board in terms of oil output, pricing. And we saw in 2022 a number of Western leaders begin to return to Saudi Arabia. Boris Johnson went, Macron went twice. Of course, Joe Biden famously fist bumped Mohammed bin Salman in July 2022, didn't seem to be too happy about it. And ironically, perhaps the campaign to isolate Vladimir Putin almost had the side effect of rehabilitating Mohammed bin Salman, at least in the West. So that's one chapter that you have to look at Mohammed bin Salman. You cannot understand what they're doing without Mohammed bin Salman being central. And of course, Vision 2030 and the Public Investment Funds are the other side of that coin. Now, there've obviously been long-term visions and plans in the Gulf and other states. Oman was the first in 1995. They had a Vision 2020. It's an interesting vision because it's obviously passed. You can see the extent to which initial hopes were not only not achieved, they fell far short, I think, of some of the final outcomes. Saudi Arabia itself had a 20-year vision in 2005. A number of economic cities were planned, King Abdullah Economic City, the King Abdullah Financial District, and those failed to take off as well. So with Vision 2030, Mohammed Salman, I think, has put, and we obviously centralized control, centralized power to a much greater extent. There's less of a siloed landscape in Saudi Arabia, where in the previous visions, if one ministry wasn't on board, they could almost block an initiative. So we've had these transformations. And also with the Public Investment Fund, which had been established in 1971, was part of the Ministry of Finance for 44 years, until in March 2015 it was transferred to the Royal Court and then to Mohammed Salman's oversight. It had initially been largely domestic focused, but in 2008 a sovereign wealth fund was actually formed, Sanabel, and in 2014 the fund was allowed to invest and establish new companies as well. So these are changes that took place before 2015, but which were there when everything changed a year later. And every major giga project since 2017 has been entrusted either to the Public Investment Fund or to its many subsidiaries for implementation and to development. Now, sport as a tool of rebranding is important. And I think Saudi Arabia has tried to present itself as a destination. They have very ambitious targets for tourism, 150 million a year by 2030. If the giga projects get off the ground, and some of them have opened, Qiddiya opened outside Riyadh, a big entertainment park. A Red Sea resort opened in 2024, there are others on the way. There will need to be an audience of investors, an audience of visitors, an audience of people willing to go to Saudi Arabia. And to people to do that, they have to want and feel like there's a buzz about Saudi, that the Saudi Arabia you thought you knew 20 years ago of 9/11 or of human rights issues, Khashoggi, Yemen, isn't the Saudi Arabia you see today, regardless of whether the changes are more than surface deep at most or not. Many countries around the world have used sport as a tool of rebranding, of national branding or soft power in different ways. Examples being the Olympics between 1960 and 72. You had Summer Olympic Games in Italy, Japan and West Germany, kind of seeding the post-war rehabilitation, bringing them back in. You had an incredible, in 1949, the San Francisco Seals baseball team went to Japan 4 years after the atom bombs, 4 years after all the bitter fighting between Japanese and American forces. They went to Japan, played games in front of almost a million people in Japan, using the shared love of baseball to bring people back together. To the extent that Douglas MacArthur, the head of US forces in Japan, actually said at the end of it, what you've achieved, 1,000 diplomats couldn't have achieved. So there was already the use of sport for rehabilitation. We saw that in South Africa in 1995, the South African Rugby World Cup, mm-hmm. The famous image of Nelson Mandela at the end, in the Springboks jersey, celebrating with the players. Of course, the players were almost all white. I think there was one black player on the team, but again, trying to kind of rehabilitate South Africa, but also bring people together after apartheid. And East Germany, between 1949 and 1990, also used sport very, very heavily to try and create a separate identity from West Germany and to try and get East Germans enthused about being East Germans. And Eric Honecker, the long-term head of East Germany, actually said sport is not an end, it's a means to an end. And I think that's what's almost exactly the same phrase that Mohammed Salman has used about sport in 2023 as well. So it's by no means unique, what the Saudis have tried to do with sports, to try and spread a message that things are changing. I think without Ronaldo, without some of the investments in sport, without boxing, a lot of people wouldn't necessarily know, who don't follow Saudi politics as closely that we do, that there's a Vision 2030, that something's happening, that things are opening up. You can now have music festivals, there are cinemas. So I think that's what they're using. They're using the unique appeal of sport, its mass appeal and its global reach, and especially in football, to really spread that message that things are changing. Now, I'll talk about sports washing in a minute, I mean, because obviously that's one of the accusations used by critics, that it's about sports washing. But I would argue that it's a message that has tangible economic objectives behind it. It's linked to the tourism initiatives, it's linked to opening Saudi Arabia up as a destination, trying to get inward investment in, and all the Giga projects, if and when they ever open, will need people to populate them. In 2023, Mohammed Salman gave an interview to Discovery Channel where he confidently predicted that by 2030, the population of Saudi Arabia would be between 50 and 55 million people. Now, that would imply an extra 20 plus million people moving to Saudi Arabia in that time, 7 years, which I think is not going to happen. But it shows the scale of the ambition, that somebody is going to have to live at Neom, somebody's going to have to live or visit the Red Sea resorts. And of course, the fact that the Red Sea then became a byword for attacks on shipping and Houthi Houthi misadventures didn't help. But it shows the importance that they attach to spreading that message. And ironically, Saudi Arabia defeating Argentina at the World Cup in Qatar in 2022. I would argue did more for Saudi soft power than anything that the leadership, Mohammed Salman, or any of the army of PR consultants in London or in Washington could do, because the scenes of jubilation, both in the stadium outside and across Saudi Arabia, was spontaneous. It was bottom up. It portrayed Saudis as one of us, as young, as fun loving, as football fanatics, and it wasn't contrived. It wasn't top-down, it was completely spontaneous. Now, of course, the Saudi team then lost the next two games, but the images were there, they went around the world, and people remember the World Cup for Saudi Arabia beating Argentina with a backflip when Al-Dosri scored the winning goal. And that showed the power of sport to change perceptions. And a week after the World Cup finished, Cristiano Ronaldo moved from Manchester United, or he'd been sacked from Manchester United during the tournament, and he then moved to Riyadh. Now, when he was unveiled with a backdrop emblazoned with Visit Saudi. So again, even for the backdrop, there was an attempt to spread a message that Saudi Arabia is open. There was, I think the tagline was Saudi, welcome to Arabia. So you can see how there was linked from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And when Cristiano Ronaldo has, I think last time I checked, is between 500 and 600 million social media followers, when he posts on Instagram about the amazing restaurants in Riyadh or the lifestyle he's enjoying. I know he's currently on strike, but until recently he'd been having a great time, or at least he'd been posting about it. And that reach goes to an audience that you cannot dream of if you're a conventional PR consultant. And of course, Lionel Messi, the other great superstar in world men's football, now the Saudis tried to sign him in 2023. He chose to go to the US, to Miami, with a deal funded largely by Apple, but he's also a Saudi tourism ambassador too. So they have the two most famous men's players acting as brand ambassadors effectively, and as 2034 ambassadors as well, really using sport to try and spread that message. Obviously in 2023, Saudi Arabia was on everyone's lips. The PIF took majority control of the four biggest Saudi clubs in June. Two in Jeddah, Al Ahly and Al Ittihad, and two in Riyadh, Al Nasr and Al Hilal. There's a big other club in Riyadh, Al Shabab, that was quite miffed that they weren't included. They also, Saudi entities linked to the PIF, also invested in teams in Neom. Well, the Neom team actually involved buying a team and moving it to Neom. In Diriyah, which is now being rebuilt as the sort of ancestral home of the Al Saud, as part of the campaign to at least try and de-link Saudi history from the Al-Wahhab. They bought a team in Al-Ula, and they invested, Aramco invested in the eastern province in Al-Qaziyah, and those teams have rocketed up the Saudi pyramid. So I think long term, there's obviously huge state investment in some of those teams. There was mayhem that summer in terms of English or European transfers, people moving to Saudi Arabia in such large numbers that teams were losing three or four of their superstars. Nobody could quite know who would stay. Saudis were not bound by European financial fair play regulations, so they could offer multiples of existing salaries, and many people went. And that was important because Ronaldo could have been like Rivellino in 1978. He could have been the only one. I went and no one else went with me. And in fact, once all the stars began coming, Ronaldo gave a press conference in September 2023, he said, see, I told you, they would come. Benzema went, he went to Al-Hilal, got injured, didn't play much, and then left. Other stars came, including Muslim stars, who were then saying this is such a better quality of life than they had in France or in Germany or in the UK. Some didn't work out. Jordan Henderson, the captain of Liverpool, left after 4 months. I think some of the games playing in front of fewer than 1,000 people in stifling heat brought home that you can't completely change things overnight, and there are certain things that will not match maybe the Premier League. But by and large, many of them have stayed, and they signed 3-year contracts, which meant they would still be in Saudi Arabia up to the World Cup this summer, in the US and Canada and New Mexico. So it's still the centre of attention. And critics claim that buying foreign stars is just all about money, but then the Saudis would have pushed back, and they did push back by saying, well, that's what the Premier League did in the 1990s. They bought foreign stars and used it to sort of maximise the appeal of this new competition. And at Euro 2024, the European Championships 2 years ago, the players playing in Saudi Arabia actually performed very well, so it wasn't seen as the career-ending move that maybe some of the critics had said. So that's where we have been up until 24. Now, of course, the elephant in the room is sports washing. Now, sports washing as a term didn't exist until about 2012. It was used once in 2012, I think in the context of an Israeli sport. It was used in the context of Israel, and then again in 2015 with the European Games in Azerbaijan, in Baku. And that was when it was really first used, I think, by Amnesty International. So when Manchester City was bought by Abu Dhabi in 2009, when Qatar got the World Cup in 2010, sports washing really hadn't even been invented as a term. But of course it was issues like that that got people thinking about why the Gulf states or other, in their view, autocratic states investing so heavily, what do they want? And it was the visibility of these investments in the early 2010s that gave the label currency. But for a long time, it was a media label. And it was often used pejoratively. It was often used in a one-way context. It was always autocratic states doing sports washing, never Western states. You could argue that, for example, in 2006, the World Cup in Germany was an extremely successful campaign to rebrand Germany as a destination. Germans were feeling proud again after many, many years, obviously with historical reason, to wave a flag. It was an extremely successful way of rebranding Germany 15 years after unification. Historically, obviously in the 1936 Olympics, sports washing of a different kind, much darker, more negative, with the Nazi Olympics in Berlin. People have argued that the Rumble in the Jungle, Muhammad Ali's fight in Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, in 1975, I think it was an excess of sports washing. It certainly was used by the government in Zaire to really sell Zaire to the world, bringing Muhammad Ali and I think Joe Frazier at the time. So it's been around for a long time. And when I started writing the book in 2023, I think there were only two journal articles that really addressed sports washing. Now at the last count, there are about 20 to 25. It seems that almost every journal on sport has been publishing on sports washing over the last several years. Most of the research is critical. People have pointed out the one directional nature of sports washing. They've also tried to really flesh out what it means in practice. How do you control the audience? Yes, you can sell something, but you can't control how the audience buys it. The example there being Qatar with the World Cup. Was it sports washing? Well, I would argue that probably a lot of people now know a lot more about labour practices, about the abuse of migrant workers, and about Qatar's attitude towards the LGBTQ communities than would have been the case had it not been for the World Cup, had it not been for the 12 years of the media scrutiny of Qatar up until 2022. So it can go both ways. And scholars have used the term soft disempowerment to make that point. Yes, you can sell something, but you can't control how it's received. There's also different types. What are you washing exactly? Is sports washing by hosting an event, are you sports washing, like with the World Cup? Are you sports washing by investing, like with Manchester City? Now, you could argue that investments, because of the passion that fans have on teams, you won't find someone in half of Manchester talking negatively about Abu Dhabi. You won't find someone in Newcastle talking about Saudi Arabia critically right now. So different types of investments produce different outcomes. And 2022 was talked about as the year of sports washing. You had the Beijing Winter Olympics in February, and then the World Cup in Qatar in November, December. And it was voted word of the year in Norway. Now, a lot of the criticism was coming from Scandinavia, from Germany, from the UK. And to some extent, I think there's also a backlash maybe among people that were uneasy at sports events happening outside the European, North American norm. And what we have seen is a globalization of major sports events over the past 20 years. We've had the first World Cups for men in Asia in 2002 in Japan, South Korea, in Africa in 2010 in South Africa, obviously the Middle East in 2022. We had the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, all hosting major events between 2008 and 2022. You had almost a monopoly on major events. 2008 Beijing Olympics, 2010 Commonwealth Games in India, the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, 2014 Brazil World Cup, 2016 Brazil Olympics, 2018 Russia World Cup, 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics, and then obviously. So we've had a globalization of sporting events unconnected to the Gulf, but is part of this, I think, backlash that we've seen among maybe a Western or at least a Northern European audience. There's also the fact that hosting a contemporary major sporting event is now so expensive that actually a lot of countries and cities, in the West especially, which are saying no. So the reason why the 2022 Winter Olympics came down to a choice between Beijing and Kazakhstan was because, for example, Oslo and Stockholm had both put the potential to bid to a city referendum and people voted against it. They didn't want to spend all the money on having a two-week event that wouldn't necessarily have much of an economic legacy. Boston pulled out of hosting the Olympics, or at least bidding to host. Munich pulled out the same reason. A lot of cities and states are refusing or much more hesitant now to get involved, which of course leaves the way open for Qatar, for Saudi Arabia, where there are fewer maybe political or democratic constraints on policymakers and the ability to, at least to spend large amounts of money. Now, I do concede in the book that the one investment in football that maybe is closer to sports washing, and I apologise to any Newcastle fans in this room, but it is Newcastle in my view. And the reason I think that is because you can't really think of an economic case for investing in Newcastle that would benefit Saudi Arabia back home. At least with creating Live Golf, the kind of rebel golf tour, you can maybe argue that a lot of these resorts being developed in Saudi Arabia need an affluent investor, tourist, traveller class. And of course, golf being a more affluent game, also with middle America in mind, there were tangible reasons for creating a golf tour and associating Saudi Arabia with golf. Whether or not those people will be willing to go and have a round along the Red Sea coast is another issue, but there were at least more tangible reasons to do so. With Newcastle, it's less clear. There were claims at the time of the acquisition in 2021 that there would be heavy Saudi investment in the northeast, hasn't yet happened. We haven't yet seen the regeneration of the surrounding area, like we have actually with Manchester, where Abu Dhabi has actually invested very heavily in East Manchester, which had been extremely deprived. And of course, the argument then is, if the British government's not going to invest, why shouldn't we go to the Gulf? Why shouldn't we go to Abu Dhabi or to Saudi? That's the argument the club or the supporters would make. That hasn't necessarily happened. I think also Newcastle was earlier on in the process of Mohammed bin Salman still very isolated in the West after Khashoggi's murder. The takeover was pushed through in 2020. It got stuck for a year and a half. So it was approved in 21. At that time, there was still a lot of negativity in the West and in the UK towards Mohammed Salman. So when the takeover was approved, the sight of thousands of Newcastle fans flooding into the streets around St. James's Park, welcoming the Saudi takeover, it sent an image, a powerful image, that you're welcome here. Our government may not like you, but you are welcome. We love you. We love Saudi Arabia. Come in. You had Labour MPs in the Northeast writing open letters to Boris Johnson, urging him to approve the takeover. Labour MPs in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet, or had been in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet, calling for the Saudi investment to go ahead. So there were reasons, I think, the investment, which was also £300 million, which, if you think about it, was actually less than the amount of money they paid for the painting, the Salvator Mundi painting. You can buy Newcastle, buy almost the support of a passionate fan base, but less than you pay for a painting, or for his yacht, for the yacht that they bought around the same time. I would argue that that maybe is the closest approximation to a sports washing, just because it was still at a time when the image of Saudi Arabia was much more vulnerable. I think I have 15 more minutes or so? Okay.
Oh.
Or 10?
Yeah, 10.
Until 6, right? Okay.
You have all the time.
No, I can't speak forever.
On this subject, you probably can.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't want to test me, though. I also have a look, because it's not the first time we've seen an attempt to basically rebrand an existing league. And there are some interesting examples from other parts of the world that I do go into. I look, for example, at the North American Soccer League in US and Canada between 1968 and 1984. Pelé joined New York Cosmos in 1977. First game, there were 50,000 people in a stadium that had been built in the 1930s under a Depression New Deal era work scheme. Grass had to be painted green for the game because it was going to be televised, and the grass was so old and sort of decrepit that they actually spray painted it green, and Pelé and everyone else got covered in green slime during the match. A number of other big stars from Europe also went to play in the North American Soccer League, but it folded in 1984. It folded for numerous reasons. One was Pelé retired in 1977. And at that time, especially in North America, the name, maybe there was less recognition of football or soccer, as they would call it, than there is today. And most Americans knew one player, they knew Pelé. And once he left, the struggle was, how do you replace a man like Pelé, or in Saudi Arabia's case, Ronaldo perhaps? How do you replace him? They bought some of the greats of European football. They bought Cruyff, they bought Beckenbauer, they bought George Best, but they didn't cut through in the national consciousness to anything like the same extent. In fact, George Best, who obviously drank himself to death and was always surrounded by an entourage of admirers and people wanting to buy him a drink, which is part of the problem, he loved playing in the US because it gave him anonymity. Mm-hmm. But that was the challenge. They couldn't replace a superstar. And once that happened, attendances began to fall, broadcasting revenues began to dry up, TV deals weren't extended, clubs began to fold, and by the last year there were only four teams left. So they struggled to replace the big name that had signed in 77, which you could argue potentially could be replicated with Ronaldo, although I think Saudi Arabia has a much stronger and deeper football route than maybe the US had in 1977. The Major League Soccer began in 1996. The first few years it really struggled. At one point, two men owned 9 of the 12 teams. just unthinkable today because you're not allowed to own stakes in more than one team. Two men effectively saved North American American League soccer. And one of them was Lamar Hunt of the Hunt oil dynasty, which was also heavily involved in Yemen, in finding and producing oil in Yemen. But two men basically saved that league before it began to grow in the 2000s when David Beckham moved in 2007. And gradually, the Major League Soccer has grown to the point that in 2023, it was more attractive for Lionel Messi to move to the US than it was to move to Saudi Arabia. The J League in Japan also struggled. It was rebranded in 1993. Initially, also had a lot of foreign, kind of aging foreign stars, including Gary Lineker, who went to play for the Japanese teams. Again, it took a long time to become profitable, to turn a profit. It took almost 15 to 20 years. These things didn't happen overnight in the US or in Japan. And the cautionary tale is the Chinese Super League. Again, rebranded in the mid-2000s. Suddenly, in the mid-2010s, crazy money started pouring in. You had Chinese state-linked entities buying and investing in teams. At one point in 2016, the Chinese teams were spending more money, I think, than the Premier League teams. You had them picking off Premier League players who were going to China. Carlos Tevez briefly was the world's best player in the world, best paid player in the world. When he went to China, he barely played. He left after 6 months and said, "I was on holiday for 6 months." He was very disobliging about it. And then suddenly that dried up. The money dried up. The Chinese government gave a nod and a wink and a signal that this wasn't sustainable, and the investment stopped. Teams went bankrupt, they stopped playing, and of course the pandemic and the severity and longevity of the Chinese lockdown didn't help. But in the 2010s, it was the Chinese who were putting crazy money into football, not the Saudis. The Chinese who had the plan to host and win a World Cup by 2030, win it by 2050. It's the Chinese who were making waves. So that's the cautionary tale. What happens if attention or focus moves elsewhere? If the Saudi government, if Mohammed Salman or whoever's around him decides, yeah, we don't necessarily think we should invest in football anymore. The Chinese is maybe the cautionary example. Now, I would argue that football in Saudi has deeper roots than they do in China. The teams are much longer in terms of their history and heritage. And now, of course, they have the World Cup. So they have eight more years of investments to look forward to. There are staging points along the way as well. There's the 2027 Asian Cup in Saudi Arabia. So they're building stadiums for that that will then be used again in 2034. There were the Asian Games in 2030 in Saudi. So there's a pipeline of big sports events over the next decade, which give me a degree of belief that although we're seeing retrenchment and scaling back of projects in other areas, I mean, NEOM is being apparently repurposed into AI data centers. The line is now maybe a full stop. It's a punctuation mark. It's not going to be 100 miles. It might not even be 100 meters. We just saw a few weeks ago the Mukab, this massive cube in Riyadh, will probably not be built after all. We're seeing downsizing and scaling back, partly because oil prices at $60 a barrel mean that difficult choices have to be made about how to allocate and prioritize resources. And also the initial hopes were in 2017 that you would have a lot of foreign investment coming in to power the project development. The problem being, in October 2017, the world business elite gathered for the first future investment initiative held by the Public Investment Fund, at which Mohammed Salman launched NEOM. NEOM Mustaqbal is a future city with a robot called Sophia that was given Saudi citizenship for the day. People went to Saudi Arabia, probably came back thinking this is so different from what I'd expected. The problem is they'd all stayed at the Ritz-Carlton, and exactly 9 days later, the Ritz-Carlton became global news for a very different reason. Foreign investment plunged. Investor confidence plunged. If your Saudi business partner could potentially disappear and be shaken down, why would you invest? And that was a challenge. So investment levels were lower than anticipated. So the Saudis ended up having to pay for the projects themselves, using, of course, government or oil revenues, which did surge in 2021-22 with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but of course now look like being much lower, much longer, and certainly lower than Saudi break-even prices, which are about $90 a barrel. So difficult decisions are being made, but because of support, the visibility and the pipeline of projects and events going to 2034, it may be that it has more durability. Now, obviously, the World Cup is going to happen in Saudi. I think it's been remarkable how in 2010 there was shock at Qatar being named host. By 2023, when Infantino basically posted on his Instagram account that Saudi Arabia was the only bidder, there was a shrug. People had more or less gotten used to it. It seemed as inevitable. But even 5 years before, the idea that a World Cup would have been in Saudi Arabia would have been seen as almost unthinkable. Now, the Saudis had developed close ties with Infantino over the past previous 4 or 5 years. Mohammed Salman sat next to Infantino at the beginning of the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. There was a Saudi-backed project to invest $25 billion in FIFA in 2018 to create an expanded Club World Cup, which happened last year. Didn't go anywhere at the time because of European backlash, but Infantino clearly had his head turned by the prospects of money coming in. It was interesting in 2030 for the World Cup, the Centenary World Cup from 1930. The Saudis were thinking initially of trying to organize a bid with Egypt and Greece, and potentially also with Italy. They were potentially spreading the hosting. Didn't happen, but it was interesting how there was never, for example, discussion of co-hosting with the UAE next door, which would have made sense from a contiguous territorial basis. But of course, Saudi Arabia and the UAE were competitive rivals in many ways. Of course, now they're openly at odds with each other as well, but it was interesting how the Saudis were willing to go with Egypt or with Greece or with Italy, but not with their neighbour next door. Infantino made his Instagram announcement and gave bidders 3 weeks to put a bid together. He said that the 2034 World Cup will be in Asia, and anyone who wants to bid has to declare an intent by the 31st of October. And this is on the 4th of October 2023. Australia had been planning to bid for the World Cup in 2034. They just had a very successful Women's World Cup. And it was impossible for the Australian government to pull together all of the state, federal, or is it state or provincial, all the different levels of government necessary to sign off on a bid in 27 days. The Saudis, it was no problem. The Saudis just said, yep, we'll do it. And it was, they were the only bidder. And so you saw then as well the difference between, and of course there was that famous FIFA quote in 2014, sometimes it's better to have less democracy when hosting a World Cup. And this is very much the case in 2023. Saudi Arabia duly emerged as the only bidding state. What was interesting in 2020, for Qatar in 22, Qatar was awarded the World Cup on the 2nd of December 2010. Now the date's important because 15 days later, Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia set himself on fire, and a month later, the region was aflame with the Arab uprisings. Had that been the other way around, had the World Cup decision been taken with countries across the Middle East in a state of uprising, the political risk of having an event in the Middle East might have been higher, and Qatar may not have won the bid. So you saw how quickly politics could overtake a winning bid. In Qatar's case, it was 15 days. In Saudi Arabia's case, it was 3 days. Because Infantino announced Saudi would be effectively the only bidder on the 4th of October 2023. 3 days later, October 7th happened, and the Gaza War, the war which led to tit-for-tat strikes between Iran and Israel, which led to the 12-day war last summer, Donald Trump joining in, not to be left out. So again, you have politics intervening even quicker than it did with Qatar. Saudi plan to build 11 new stadiums. I will have to see if the one at Neom, which apparently will be several hundred meters into the air, will ever get built. There has been a backlash to some extent. Saudi Arabia has tried to sponsor the Women's World Cup. That did hit a backlash. There were female players who did not want Saudis to get involved. There were the vulnerabilities to geopolitics, to Iran, to the Houthis, to potential for a new war. We've seen in Morocco how the Gen Z protests so targeted the World Cup spending for 2030, something potentially, you know, allocating huge numbers of resources can produce a backlash. we just had last week the decision or the announcement that the Asian Winter Games will not now take place in Saudi Arabia, that the idea of building a winter resort in Neom or the mountains behind Neom is just too difficult, too costly, and so the new president of the Olympic Council of Asia, who is the brother of the Emir of Qatar, his first big decision was to reallocate those games, which will now take place in Kazakhstan. Officially, the Saudis want to host at some point in the future, but I suspect we may never get to enjoy our winter sports in Saudi Arabia. That was a bellwether, I think, of some of the ability to turn projects into reality, almost vision into reality. It's much more difficult on the ground. You can have glitzy computer-generated animations, but actually building it is a lot more complicated and complex. I think even with the line, there was an article last year in the Wall Street Journal that even building a mile of the line would basically use up almost the entire global supplies of cement and glass, and would be the equivalent of basically building a Manhattan concentration of skyscrapers. But finally, I think also it's bought Mohammed Salman time. 2030, the vision 2030, the year that he promised in 2016, he would transform Saudi Arabia. Now, 2030 seems a long time distant in 2016. It's not anymore. It's 4 years away, less than 4 years away. But now the World Cup is in 2034. It's a new time horizon. You can extend the time horizon. Everything will be ready for 2034. You can have another 4 years. You have a bit of a buffer. So I think 2034 will replace 2030 as the time horizon for a lot of these projects and for a lot of Saudi speak. And so I think, if for nothing else, the World Cup will provide a good breathing space. Just because if 2030 comes and nothing's been built, would there be a backlash? Wouldn't there? Would people care? I mean, there's been a lot of progress on other parts of Vision 2030, on women in the workforce, on people owning homes, on so the bread and butter issues that actually matter to Saudis, not necessarily to an external audience. So at least for the external audience, 2034 is perhaps the new 2030. So with that, I'll pass it back to you, Rehan. Thank you very much.